So here we are about to enter what the world calls the Christmas season. Well, actually, the holiday season. Let's be politically correct. And we're going to talk about tonight how we are different than the world, which is, I hope, the main message that people are thinking about, because the world's getting to be a very dark place. And if you look at things, even in the last 10 years, how far we've fallen, the great falling away that Paul talks about when he writes to the Thessalonians, we're seeing it happen. How many people can find a Sunday night service or a Wednesday night service anymore? Boy, when I first became a believer, we were going to Sunday night and Wednesday night services all over the place. There was a really nice one at all the vineyards. Now, you can't find a Sunday night or Wednesday night almost anywhere. Or if somebody does have it, there'll be four people there. So the great falling away has happened. We're seeing the great denominations of the world kicking their foundations out from under their buildings. We're going to do a session on that sometime after the new year. But things are different. The world is now telling us, hey, it's holiday season about to start. And I actually know some people who don't have their lights up or their tree up yet. But because you're supposed to put it up right after Halloween or right after Labor Day, or I can never keep all that straight. But the world is telling you now for the next 6 weeks or so, you're going to be partying, you're going to be eating, you're going to be drinking, and you're going to be just buying as much stuff as you can buy. And this is what life is all about. Right? And from the, I almost said the word, from the advent of Christianity, this time of year has been called Advent. From the Latin, it means waiting for the coming. This is a time where we're waiting for Messiah to be born. I mean, not literally, but it's a commemoration of Messiah being born. And I know he wasn't born December 25th. Everybody knows that. And we're not going to get into that. You know, there's all kinds of theories about that. But since the Christian tradition has picked that as the day that's celebrated, let's just assume he's born December 25th, and we can worry about all the details later. So one of the things I'm going to ask when we're in heaven, is I'm going to say, what day were you actually born? And if he says December 25th, I'll say, cool. If he says, you know, October 14th, I'll say, great. If he says April 3rd, I'll say, great. If he says July 8th, I'll say, great. Right? At that point, I'm not going to care when he was born. But we are preparing for this. So we're waiting for a coming. Actually, when you think about it, we've been in the second advent since Jesus ascended into heaven from the top of the Mount of Olives. Because he's going to come back again. I hope it's tonight. But he's going to come back soon. I mean, you look around and, you know, Peter writes that, oh, there's always scoffers that are going to come and say, oh, everything's been like this all the time and everything, nothing's changed since the time of the fathers. And so why don't you guys just chill out? We've never seen a world like it is now. And when you take into account the fact that Israel exists as a nation, the technology that there is, the political structures that are forming with one world government and all this, we're getting very close. So, I mean, close might be 50 years, but close might be next week. But I doubt it's going to be 2,000 more years. So, what are we waiting for compared to what the world is waiting for? And although we're not quite in the Advent season yet, we're not legalists here. We can talk about what we're waiting for. We're waiting for a coming. And how does this all go down? I mean, how do we even perceive what we're waiting for? You know, the world is waiting for a holiday season. In fact, when I used to witness to people at the office and they would talk about the holiday stuff and I would say, the last thing the Western world should be doing is celebrating Christmas. We're just digging our hole deeper when the judgment comes. Because like everything else that's been perverted, the season of celebrating Messiah's birth has been perverted to call it holiday season, so nobody's offended. So if you're a Buddhist or you're a Muslim or whatever you are, you can celebrate the holiday season without knowing a thing about why this was a holiday season, because the word holiday comes from holy day, why this is a holy day season. And to find out how this gets started, we're just going to hit highlights of it because we're going to do it for a couple of more weeks. Well, next week we're not meeting, remember. But then we're doing a couple of weeks more of this, and then we'll have the Hanukkah party. But we'll talk more about that. But you have to go back to Genesis chapter 3. Now, how many people know Genesis is the first book? Probably everybody, right? If you don't, then see Pastor Monica afterwards. And we get the word Genesis from the Greek word for the beginnings. My Greek's not very good. It's genoseo or something like that. But the Hebrew word is bereshit, and the beginning. They named everything usually by the first couple of words of something, like the prayers, the songs, the books. But in going back to Genesis, we'll say call it Genesis so we don't get all mixed up. My wife's always telling me when you use people's Hebrew names or Hebrew words for something, then people zone out and say, I don't know what he's talking about. But everybody knows what Genesis is. So Genesis chapter 3, now this is immediately after the fall. They're still in the garden. They haven't left the garden yet. This is the first proclamation of the gospel. In Greek, it's called the Proto-Evangelion, the first, like, prototype gospel. And I, meaning God, will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. So he's talking to the serpent. Somebody's coming from the seed of the woman who's going to crush your head. You're going to bite at his heel. You might scratch him a little bit, but he's going to crush your head. Because this rebellion now that you've unleashed is going to be taken care of. Right? Can I get an amen? Amen. And the other interesting thing here is you see, he talks about the seed of the woman. So this means when Messiah comes, he's not going to have an earthly father. Because in, you know, ancient terms, the seed comes from the man. Women don't have seed. Well, obviously, we know that they do. But in ancient times, you know, the man somehow fertilized the woman. They didn't know all the biology, of course. So they didn't talk about women having seed. They talked about men having seed. So this is a first indication that God says to Adam and Eve and the snake, see, Eve should have never listened to a talking snake. But even if she did, Adam, who was the spiritual head of the house, the spiritual head of the family, just the two of them, the spiritual head of the whole garden, should have stepped in and said, Eve, stop listening to him. We're not violating God's law. He told us not to do this. We're not going to do it. So I cast you out of here. But Adam doesn't say a word. He takes a bite of the fruit, doesn't say a word. So he totally abdicates his whole spiritual position. Right? So even though we like to call it, well, you know, as he says later, you know, that woman you put here, she did it. You know, she made me do it. And she blames the serpent. Adam blames Eve. But the issue is that Adam was at fault as well. So it's called the sin of Adam. So he's going to crush your head. So somebody's coming. You guys have now created a problem that you cannot fix. That we are still living under. This is why our hair gets gray. This is why we get bald. This is why we get sick. This is why we get decrepit. This is why things go wrong. This is why there's hurricanes. This is why there's whatever. Because it's a fallen world. We're still living in this because of those two. But something, someone is coming. Someone is coming. Then we may move, we fast forward, I don't know how many years it was, because nobody knows when Adam and Eve lived. But we know Samuel, his Hebrew name is Shmuel, we know Samuel lived about 1000 BC, more or less. So, this is about King David. Through the prophet Nathan, God tells David, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. Whoa. So what is he telling David? The Messiah, when he comes, the one who's going to fix the problem, is going to come from your seed. He's going to come from your body. He's going to be biologically related to you. So what's one of Messiah's main titles? Son of David. He's going to literally come from your body, and I, meaning God, am going to establish his kingdom. Now, the H and the K should be capitalized. I was negligent. Okay? So he, meaning the Messiah, is going to build a house for my name. I'm going to establish his throne forever. And guess what? I'm going to be called his father, and he's going to be called my son. Woo! How many times is this read in the synagogues? How many times is this read in any Jewish setting, prayer meeting, whatever, and they don't react to it? Isn't that amazing? You know, even in the book of Proverbs, I can't remember the, I was going to look it up and I forgot. You know, it says something like, do you know the name of God's son? You know, it's in the Hebrew scriptures, of course. But the Jews say God can't have a son. That's idolatry. The Muslims say God can't have a son because he's God and we're human. So there's a solution for that too. Now we go forward a little bit, about 300 years to about 750 BC, when Isaiah, my favorite major prophet, prophesies about Yeshua Jesus unbelievably accurately 750 years before it actually happens, before he's even born, describes the crucifixion in horrible detail. There was no crucifixion in Isaiah's time. 700 years in the future. Then he said, this is God talking through Isaiah, hear now, O house of David. Whose house? David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. That sounds kind of weird. First of all, virgins don't conceive. First of all, it's a sign that God himself is going to give. It's not something prophets are going to be talking about. It's not something that some high priest is going to plan. It's a word that God himself is going to give you that you can't imagine. In the scope of human history, you can't imagine a virgin conceiving and bearing a child. So it's a sign that God himself is going to give. So if he's going to give you the sign, this is really powerful. If the sign is he's going to crush the serpent's head, he's going to crush the serpent's head. If the sign is he's coming from David, he's coming from David. If the sign is a virgin's going to bear him, a virgin's going to bear him. No one would even think of such a thing. Now, like many prophecies, all these things are couched in a whole other series of things that are going on. And we're not going to get into that, but if you read through Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and if you read through the Psalms especially, they're talking about something else, and all of a sudden there's a messianic prophecy that jumps out at you. But no one would think of such a thing. They knew Messiah was going to come from David. Jesus asked the Pharisees, whose son is the Christ? I think we did that here once. Whose son is the Messiah? And they all said, David. Nobody knows that he's the son of David. You know, God's had it with King Ahaz. We're not going to get into that. And he says, you know, I'm tired of you. I'm going to give you a sign. Now, why this messianic sign would come in the middle of this chastising of King Ahaz, I don't know. Sometimes it's okay to say, I don't know. I'm sure there's some theologian who knows Aramaic and Hebrew and whatever else that can probably tell you, but I don't know. I spent a lot of time lately in the book of Daniel. I got like two groups in Daniel, a church in Daniel, the church service in Daniel. Spent a lot of time in Daniel. And, you know, it's complicated. And I was laughing one night because I was trying to make a handout. So I was reading these ancient commentaries about Daniel, like from the fathers, like the 300s, the 400s. So I was scanning them and I was trying to understand their language. I got to Thomas Aquinas, who said, I don't understand what this means. That was his whole commentary. But then, well, at least he's honest. He didn't know what it meant. But, you know, the real king is coming. You know, Ahaz, you're a disaster. Let me tell you. But the real king is coming. And this is what it's really all about. Now, why does he say you're going to call him Emmanuel? His name wasn't Emmanuel. His name was Yeshua. When the angel Gabriel comes to Mary, he doesn't say, oh, remember, you got to name him Emmanuel. He tells her, you're going to name him Yeshua. Why? Because he's going to deliver people from their sins. His name means salvation. Jesus' name, Yeshua, means salvation. His name is also his job description, so to speak, which is pretty cool. And again, so I don't know how much Gabriel knew about the plan of salvation, but probably more than any humans did. But he doesn't tell Mary, well, whatever you guys want to name this baby is okay. I'm just here to tell you, you're going to have a child and it's not going to be Joseph's child. But, you know, whatever you want to name him, you want to name him Fred or Bob, you know, that's okay. No, he says you're going to name him Yeshua. And then it says when the eighth day came and it was time for his circumcision, they named him Yeshua like the angel had told them. So Mary and Joseph didn't say, what kind of name is that? How can we name a kid Salvation? I think we should name him Fred. No, they obeyed. So Emmanuel, of course, means God with us. Emmanuel, which means with us is God in the Hebrew. Emmanuel, when you have that E, A-N-U at the end of a word, that means ours or we. So when you say Adonainu, you're saying our Lord. We can go through all that, but, and some of you can probably sing songs that have those words in it. But it means our or we, and E-L is the word for God. It's one of the main words for God. So this means God is with us. Literally, it means with us is God. So who's coming? Somebody's going to come to crush the head. Virgin's going to conceive a bear a son. Going to be biologically related to David. And you're going to name him God with us. That means he's going to be God with us. No one had thought of this before. Just like nobody thought a virgin was going to conceive and bear a son, no one thought we're going to have God living with us. Sure, God had mentioned, you know, I'm going to make my dwelling place with you. That's why I want the temple built. I'm going to have a place where I'm going to live. But this is different. This is God actually living with us when they knew better than we do, because we live in the new covenant, the covenant of grace, not a covenant of law. When you study the Torah, everything is about how God and people are separated. Right? Meticulous instructions of how you build the worship place. And that's why churches look the way they do. Because this is what the tent looked like. This is what the temple looked like. The holy things were over here, and the sinful people were over here, and there was a big separation that nobody could go through. Because unholy things couldn't approach the holy things. You approach God in the way that he tells you to approach. Then the book of Hebrews, it says, now we can approach boldly because the veil's been torn down. Right? Before it was, everything's got to be built like this. These certain prayers have to be said. This certain ritual has to be done. That's how you approach. Now, all of a sudden, the prophet says God's going to be living with us. This is a totally different concept. If you think Messiah is going to be a great military leader, a really intelligent, you know, president or king or, you know, government leader, so the government's going to be on his shoulders. You know, they had all these ideas of Messiah was going to restore the kingdom of David and Solomon. And we'll show those Gentiles a thing or two when we have a really cool kingdom again. But now all of a sudden we're talking about God with us. You know, it took Peter a long time to get this. And I'm sure the other guys. You know, Jesus gives him the Great Commission, gives him this beautiful story. He's literally just about to ascend into heaven. And Peter goes, oh, are you going to restore the kingdom now? Like, okay, cool. I get all this, but when are you going to restore the kingdom? And when he said, well, that's not for you to know, they probably said, what do you mean? This is what they've been looking forward to all their life. You know, we found the Messiah. We're going to be in the new kingdom. This is going to be awesome. Well, they were in the new kingdom, and it was awesome eventually. Their life wasn't real awesome when it first started out. They all had very difficult lives. So the separation was going to be gone. It means God living with us. Now, how can that be possible? Living in our humanity. I was going to include, and then I didn't get to it today because I was babysitting all day, but I was going to include a picture from all the missions we did in Mexican garbage dumps, and then I was going to include some representation of heaven with the idea that Yeshua as the God-man went from this glory of heaven to living in this garbage dump where we live. I mean, we ministered to people who lived in physical garbage dumps, but we live in a moral garbage dump, which when you think about it is worse. But since I didn't put the pictures in, it's going to be living in our humanity. So he's going to be God with us, but living in our humanity, sharing in our lives. I mean, all you have to do is read the Gospels and you see how he was sharing in those guys' lives. You know, when Andrew comes to him, he goes and gets his brother Peter, Simon. He says, we found the Messiah. When he calls Philip, not me, the other one, he goes and gets his friend Nathaniel and says, hey, we've come and see who we found. He tells the woman at the well, I'm the one. She goes and gets everybody in the town to come and talk to him. Because their lives are totally impacted now. I mean, all of you, when you met the Lord, knows what that feels like. You don't say, well, I met the Lord, but I just better be quiet. You know, I don't want anybody to think I'm crazy. And, you know, after all, my faith is a private matter. I don't think there's anywhere in the scriptures that it says your faith is a private matter. You're supposed to shout it from the rooftops, right? If you deny him, he's going to deny you, and, you know, all those passages. And so it's not a secret. He's going to be sharing in our lives, and he's going to have both natures, but he's going to experience it all. Imagine little Jesus growing up in Nazareth and seeing the neighbors over here arguing and seeing the guy over there stealing money out of somebody's business and the guy who lives over here running around with some woman and the people who live over there, you know, they're going to the synagogue and they're trying to do the right thing. And I mean, imagine all the human experiences he had. And then spending 3 years with those dopes. Like, how many times did he sit there rolling his eyes going, can't take this anymore? You know, when it said he got away by himself, I think he probably got, like, tired of those guys and said, I got to get away from y'all for a while. No, he only said y'all when he was in the southern part of the country. In Galilee, they don't say y'all because it's in the north. So he experienced all of it. John knew a little bit about Jesus. 3 years with him, young guy, teenager, sat next to him at the Last Supper, the last messianic seder that he had on earth. Knew him pretty well. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John didn't say, you know, we met this really interesting guy who seems to be really smart, was really good at telling stories, and he was really a good philosopher. He, like, told us how we should live. I mean, he's a really interesting guy, and I'm really kind of glad I met him, because now I have a whole different outlook on my life. You know, I've got positive thinking now. And I'm pretty sure that my life's going to be better now. I'm going to start a home business on my computer. I'm going to get everything I do is going to be great. No, he says the Word, and you know what comes before this. You know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He's the Logos, the Word, becomes flesh and dwells among us. The Greek word is pitches his tent with us. He doesn't come to live at the temple. He doesn't come and have a bunch of people build a gold mansion where he can live. He comes and pitches a tent with this sorry bunch of guys. Grows up with these poor people. I mean, you think Jesus could have said to Joseph, you know, foster dad, or gee, dad, or whatever he called them. I know you're working hard and your business isn't really going well and we're all kind of poor, but I can take care of that. No. He experiences all of it, including suffering and death eventually. And we beheld his glory. You know, Isaiah says there's nothing that makes you look at him. He looks just like everybody else. There's nothing that draws your attention to him. He says, we beheld his glory, the only begotten of the Father. So who is this? He's the Son of the Father. So this is John, who knew him pretty well. Yeah, you know, he kind of came and he pitched his tent with us. It's the word that tabernacle comes from. It's a tent. which is a temporary dwelling. He's here for a while. Like when we celebrated Sukkot, we talked about here we are in these temporary dwellings. You know, our tents are falling apart. No matter what we do, they're going to fall apart. They're temporary dwellings. And, you know, the gospel says he grew in wisdom and stature before God and before the people. So, you know, he's 12-year-old Jesus. He's in the temple debating with the teachers. Mary and Joseph come and say, how could you do this to us? We've been worried sick about this for 3 days. They says, well, it's my father's house and this is where I'm supposed to be. But then he went back and was obedient to them. And it says he grew in wisdom and stature. So people who knew him said, boy, you know, that young man's really smart and he's really nice. And he really seems to know the scriptures. And I can't remember anything that he's ever done wrong that I've ever experienced. And in Hebrews 2:17, it said he was made like his brethren. You know, he's our brother too, because we're, us and he are, he and us, he and we, are descended from Adam and Eve, ultimately. So he's our brother in the flesh. The book of Hebrews talks about this. He's not ashamed to call us brethren. This is a way big difference from separation of the holy things and the non-holy things. Right? He's made like his brethren. He looked like everybody else. He didn't glow. He didn't have a halo over his head. He didn't walk 3 feet off the ground. Nobody saw him and said, oh, what is that? He looked just like everybody else. With a real body and real heredity, as we've talked about a million times. And the plan of salvation pointed to this. Because as you know, and as you all knew when you came to the Lord in the first place, this was the only solution to the sin problem. There's no other way to solve the sin problem. You can work at it, and you should. You know, God told Cain, you know, you can master it. But I don't know about you, but it's pretty tough to master. Some days you can master it. Some days you can't. Sometimes you can master it for an hour or two, and then you can't. Right? We got Adam's nature. So everything pointed to this. And of course, he had to be the perfect sacrifice, so he had to have both natures. So what are we waiting for? Are we waiting for a philosopher? Are we waiting for somebody like Confucius, who gives all kind of interesting laws about how kids should interact with their parents and the importance of, you know, your ancestors and your family? And, you know, do we have, like, what was that guy's name with the Peel, the power of positive thinking? Is that the kind of thing he had in mind? I'm here to show you guys how you can think positively so nothing will go wrong for you. And you'll succeed in your business, too. No, he came to be a perfect sacrifice. Both natures, the only solution to the sin problem. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, in other words, we have flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same. That through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. You can't conquer death if you don't die and then come back. That conquers death. He partook of flesh and blood, okay? Little boy Jesus in Nazareth, he's running with his friends, he falls down and skins his knee. Does it hurt? Yes. Does he bleed if he gets hurt? Yes. Does he ever get a cold? Yes. Does he ever get a splinter when he's working in the wood shop? Yes. He experiences all the flesh and blood stuff, but he's here to destroy him who had the power of death. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. He had to be made like his brothers, but live a perfect life in order to be a perfect sacrifice. Right? The Bible says without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sin. So does that mean, you know, if I have somebody stab me and I stand here bleeding, is that going to make up for my sins? No, it wouldn't even make up for one. No, but his blood makes up for all of it, but he has to have blood. If his body is a cosmic projection or an illusion, that can have blood. For every high priest is taken from among men, is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he might offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. That's what the high priest did. We just did Yom Kippur not too long ago. Went into the Holy of Holies with the blood. That was his mission. He got to wear the cool stuff, went in with the blood. So the high priest had to be taken from among men. An angel couldn't come and be the high priest. You couldn't say, this horse is my high priest. The high priest is taken from among men. So he has to be taken from among men to be the eternal high priest. And he offers gifts and sacrifices just like the priest did. But his sacrifice is himself. Right? He's the priest, he's the victim, and the cross is the altar. All the things that go into a sacrifice at the temple, he takes care of on Good Friday. So also consequently, we don't have a high priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses. Because he lived as a human. He saw humanity. He knows how weak you are. He knows how weak we all are. You know, God's not in heaven and says, I can't believe Fred died. I can't believe he just did this. I would have never thought of that. I would have never thought he would do something like that. You think God ever says that? No. Because he knows what you're going to do. Remember in Psalm 139, I think, you know, before a word is formed on our tongue, he knows it completely. So before you can even yell at somebody and call them a jerk, he knows you're about to do that. He's like us in all points, you know, tempted like we are, but without sin. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sin, and then for the people's. For this he did once for all, when he offered himself up. Remember, the high priest had to sacrifice over and over again for his sin, and then the sins of the people. The Messiah we're waiting for now, sort of poetically speaking, doesn't have to offer sacrifices for his sin, just for our sin. So it says the Messiah is holy, and he's sinless, and he's passed through the heavens. You know, the writer to the Hebrews, which is my favorite book of the whole Bible, you know, the writer to the Hebrews talks about how the high priest goes through the veil to go into the Holy of Holies with the blood. But Jesus, as the eternal high priest, goes through the veil of the heavens to God's throne with his blood. That was a prefigurement. That was a type. That was a shadow of what he was going to do. This is what we're waiting for. Not waiting for Santa. I don't care if you have little kids, you can do Santa. Don't send me emails saying that that was stupid. I had a guy come to one of my home prayer meetings once, and the Christmas tree was up, and I don't want to get into that. And he said, "Don't you think that's pagan?" And I said, "Only if you worship it." If I see you bowing down to the Christmas tree, then we're going to have an issue. So we have a high priest who's seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty, a minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected, not man. The high priest worked in a place that men made, but he's in a place that's not made by human hands, the writer to the Hebrews says. So what is all this for? This is what we should be thinking about. You know, just like when it gets to be Passover / Easter season, and if you don't want to call it Easter, I don't care. Call it Resurrection Day. But Passover time, Holy Week, Easter / Resurrection Day, people always say to me, oh, what do you do for Good Friday? I say, every day is Good Friday for me. Right? If you don't think about the cross 20 times a day, you don't get what happened there. If you think about it on Good Friday, then the rest of the year, you're like, well, I'll wait till next Good Friday to think about it again. You know, what do you do for Easter? Every day is Resurrection Day. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians, if there was no resurrection, then we're still in our sin, because he didn't conquer death. And we're the most pathetic of all people, because we put our hopes in a dead guy. You know, you put your hopes in a dead guy, what does that get you? You know, you notice how many times in the Old Testament it talks about the living God. It's always referred to, he's always referred to as the living God. You know, he's not an idol, he's not some God who pops up once in a while. That's what we're waiting for to happen. I don't care if you decorate your house, and I don't care if you have Santa, and I don't care if you put up whatever. But this is what we're waiting for. And just like in the springtime with the spring feast, we know that that's where our redemption is. We know now that here, the God-man was physically born in a place. It's really pretty amazing. Anybody been to Bethlehem? It's you guys have been there, I'm sure. It's pretty amazing. You know, you go into this church, which is Orthodox. It's Armenian and Greek and mostly Armenians. And you go down in this little thing and you have to kind of bow to go in because the headroom is kind of like this. And they built it that way so that you go in there humble and you don't go in there like, oh, so this is the place? I mean, you basically have to go in on your knees or bent over. And there's this spot with this beautiful kind of flaming star around it. It says, this is the very spot where Jesus was born. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I mean, maybe he was actually born 12 feet that way. Or, you know, 100 yards that way. But in this general area, this actually did happen. So this is kind of the frame of mind we should be in now.